This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
The rest of us who have maybe been here before, but we've never really been here before, have we? We're really lucky that we have our friend Ben Connolly here. This is my friend Ben Connolly, everyone. He's also your friend. Don't listen, I don't want to be a big fan, but he's kind of famous in our little tiny little microcosmos of Zendom. He's written many books, which I highly recommend. I read them. And he's a wonderful teacher, a wonderful friend to Jikoji, and a wonderful carrier and transmitter and sharer of this relationship we all have together. And now I'll get to the official introduction. Ben Connolly is a Soto Zen teacher and Dharma heir in the Katagiri lineage, friend of Koblenz, by the way. He also teaches mindfulness in a wide variety of secular contexts, including police training and addiction recovery groups. He works with multi-faith groups focused on intersectional liberation, racial justice, climate justice. Ben serves the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, travels, luckily to us, to teach across the United States, has written for Tricycle and Lion's Roar, these are Buddhist magazines, and is author of Inside the Grass Hut, Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara, Vasubandhu's Three Natures, and Mindfulness and Intimacy. We've been lucky enough to be sitting Sesshin with him, which is the last few days of intensive meditation, and we're very grateful that he's here with us today. And we welcome him to our teaching today. We're going to do the gatha, and then you get to speak. It's on.
And I'm surpassed, penetrating, and perfect dharma. It is rarely that with even 100,000 million kalpas, having its three and its two, to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How sweet to see you all here. Thank you for that just warm-hearted introduction. It's very humbling, and I'm just amazed and grateful that I get to be here with you. What a mystery that the entire universe can be happening and we can be here right now. You can find all the explanations you want for this, but it's beyond anything we could possibly pin down. So I'm just grateful it's arrived, that I have arrived and you have arrived. And we've been doing a session, which is called Gathering the Mind. So meditation intensive retreat for a couple of days, about a dozen of us here. So some of you may be really tired of meditating at this point. And some of you may be like, well, I just tried it for the first time. So however we are, wonderful. Wonderful that we're together. So I've been talking about the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is kind of like not normally understood to be beginner's material. So if you're new to Buddhism and this talk just seems completely far out, well, I hope you can enjoy far out. but I will do my best to talk in a way that can be beneficial to all of us. That's what I'll try and do. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the Avatamsaka, which means flower garland. Avatamsaka is usually, in Chinese, they call it Hua Yan or Hua Yan. My Chinese pronunciation is terrible, so I'm trying. Japanese, we say Kegon. Korean, Hwaum. So this particular piece of literature is... We could just have like a workout session and have each person just try and, you know, lift it, because it is, in fact, the largest sutra in the Buddhist tradition. 1,400 pages, very expansive, as the people in the session have been learning. You know, the sutra is fundamentally about realizing connection, the inescapable connection that we have with the entire universe at all times. Similar to what Dr. King, Martin Luther King, called in his letter from Birmingham jail, our inescapable network of mutuality. The idea of the text is that our liberation is always bound to the liberation of everyone else, and everyone else's liberation is bound to ours. We always have a role in promoting the possibility of people being free from suffering at every single moment, and countless things are supporting us. And also, there's a lot of suffering that we can meet, which we can develop compassion for. So people often say that the Avatamsaka and the Huayan Buddhist tradition that it produced really focus on interdependence. Also, a big focus of this text is abundance, because there are so many jewels, so many beautiful instruments described in this, so many amazing banners, clouds passing through the sky, incredible worlds full of beautiful sights, people singing amazing songs, people delivering all different kinds of teachings. It's very expansive. So it is intended to evoke a sense of joy and wonder and amazement. And the thing is, the text is for that, but our practice is for that. To be able to walk out of this room and find joy and wonder and amazement. And I'm sure every single one of us, every moment of our lives, is experiencing joy, wonder, and amazement. Well, maybe not. But we can try and call this up in ourselves so that when we develop the compassion and the wisdom that are the fundamental invitations of this tradition, it can come with some lightness, because compassion often comes with some heaviness. You know, when we look at the suffering in the world and in ourselves, it can be kind of heavy feeling. So anyway, the talk that I'm giving today is going to focus on one very small section, about one page out of these 1,400 pages. And is the basic theme of this talk is not turning away and not harming, not turning away and not harming. Or another way of putting it would be nonviolence, a fundamental ethic that underlies all Buddhist practice. Say ahimsa in the Sanskrit. So the section I want to talk about is a little chapter towards the end of the sutra. There's 400 pages, just a small section. Which is about a young pilgrim named Sudana, who really just wants people to be free and becomes inspired. And so he starts asking people, how can I help everyone be free from suffering? And he goes to meet someone and they tell him this amazing answer. They're really good at helping people be free from suffering. And they say, but actually, I don't really know. You better talk to this other person. And then he goes to that person and they have an amazing answer and a great practice for how to help people be free from suffering. And then they say, you know, but I don't actually know. You should try this other person. So he meets 53 different people, all of whom are amazingly involved in helping people be free from suffering. Some of them are practicing meditation a lot. Some of them are feeding people who are hungry. One of them is making beautiful smelling perfume so that people can smell beautiful scents. There's a whole bunch of night goddesses. There's a bunch of earth goddesses who come together and magically transform the earth into jewels, which would be nice. I would welcome them to show up at any time. All kinds of amazing things happen in this text. But there's an enormous diversity of approaches, which is one of the reasons I've been teaching this and I've emphasized quite a bit in my talks here. But I'm going to talk about a particular teacher today that the pilgrim, whose name is Sudana, meets. Sudana meets probably about the 20th teacher he meets, is called Maitrayani. And she, I can't remember who he's talking to before he goes to see her, but this other amazing person is like, well, okay, I've given you my approach. Pretty cool, but I don't really know how to free everyone from suffering. So you should talk to Maitrayani. So he goes to meet her. And when he meets her, she says she has attained the ability to face in all directions. Each one of these teachers describes a particular mode of being which informs how they help people. So it might be like being able to feed people, or it might be able to touch people in a healing way, or be able to develop medicines, or to develop arts and sciences. But Maitreyani says, my ability is to face in all directions. And she also describes, she usually they'll have two ways of describing it, and then there'll be like 470 others. For those of you who've been here all weekend, you get the vibe. But here, you'll get kind of a primary heading and then a secondary one. So she says, I've developed the ability to face in all directions, and I have attained access to perfect wisdom by way of the array of totality through various ways of entry into it, each different. So when she says, I have attained access to perfect wisdom, that's a translation of saying, I have attained access to Prajna Paramita. And I don't know how long your memory is, but about 15 minutes ago, I think everyone in this room basically worshipped Prajna Paramita. So the central rituals of Soto Zen are around putting our body on the ground and invoking the power in the name of Prajna Paramita. So the Heart Sutra, which we chanted, is about how someone who's infinitely compassionate, Avalokiteshvara, is able to be infinitely compassionate. And they say, Avalokiteshvara, he, she, or they, as you prefer, since they're gender fluid, says, by seeing Prajna Paramita, that's how you do it. And our tradition is about vast compassion. It's about helping people understand how to meet suffering so we can actually help. And the claim here is the most effective and direct route, what we should really be focusing on, is realizing the perfection of wisdom, Prajna Paramita. And Maitreyani says, I have attained access to Prajna Paramita by way of the array of totality. So that's why seeing everything, back to this facing in all directions, this ability to really have a broad view. Through various ways of entry into it. So this is where you might think, oh, like this is about someone who has like a magical mind that can know everything. But she says, I see the whole by seeing particular things. Various ways of entry into it. This has been one of the themes of our retreat, just like, how can I eat this bowl of food and really see the whole world comes together so that I can be eating this food? How many conditions has to happen so that there can be oatmeal here? You can try and list the things that have to happen for your bowl of oatmeal to exist, and you'll never stop listing things until you die. And you won't have begun to get started. It's really vast. So much connection. So she sees the whole through the particular, and that's how she accesses perfect wisdom, which is what this tradition says will get us to the compassion that underlies the whole thing. So, Prajna Paramita. Now, I don't know about you. I came to Zen centers when I first started practicing about 25 years ago. I would come to the Zen center and we'd meditate. And I was like, well, this is what I came here for. I thought meditation would help me be less miserable because I was really not doing well. And then they get up and we do this ritual where we all chanted the Heart Sutra and we did a bunch of bows. And I was like, I have no idea what we're doing. This text is so weird. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. What? What is that? No birth and death and no extinction of them? What is this? So kind of mystifying. And I just want to say, what Prajna Paramita is pointing to is that there is nothing that you can control and nothing you can hold on to. And if you really see that, you're free, because you're not trying to control anything or hold on to anything. And all the suffering we accrue comes from trying to hold on to and control things that cannot be held or controlled. This is the basic idea. So, like, why? It sounds weird. No eyes, no ears, no nose. So I'm not going to try and unpack all the fancy philosophy, but just, well, if there's not all these objects, there's not objects to control. It's not an objectified world. Feminist theories were really smart. They said, if you objectify the female body, you harm both yourself and the person you're objectifying. But this actually is just an extension of the basic premise of Mahayana Buddhist philosophy, that if we objectify the world, we both alienate ourselves from it, and that harms both us and who we have objectified. So what if we see a world not of objects to control? What is that like? And it gets, then you go, well, why would I do anything? And basically, I don't have time to unpack all of Buddhist philosophy here, but the basic idea is what you give matters, but you can't control anything. What you give always matters, and you can't control anything. So if you make an offering, it goes into the world, it influences the world, but it's not controlling particular objects within it. So we can, this like gives us invitation to live from a sense of just like, it's like this, what can I offer? Which, I don't know, sometimes I'm with people and I don't want to live that way. I want to just get them to do what I want them to do. Why are all these stupid people in my way? Or, you know, like, if everyone would just get on board with my plan, it would all go correctly, wouldn't it, boss? It doesn't work that way. That's not liberation. That's not liberation. And change our relationship to our experience. So, she says, I've attained access to perfect wisdom, prajnaparamita, through the arrangement of totality. So this, I just want to say that this evokes the flavor of wholeness, completeness, connectedness. How much human suffering comes from feeling alienated, alone, separate. It's painful. And we can acknowledge that that's real. It's pervasive. And then we could say, what about finding ways to feel whole, connected, and together without leaving anyone out, facing in all directions? When you try and control things, it's not intimate. You know, there's a pushing away and a, what if you're like, oh, you're like this, what's my offering? And just to be clear, your offering might be like, what you said really made me upset, and I'm asking you not to do it anymore. That could be an offering. Did I say, what you said made me upset, you have to stop? No, that would be trying to control. So you can be very assertive from the position of giving. It's fine. There's a difference between asserting and controlling, because you're not focused on that object, which isn't an object. It's probably a person, and they matter. So, wholeness, connection, how do we find that? If you feel alienated and cut off, I encourage you to honor that you feel that way and consider how you can generate connection and wholeness, because it's valuable. There are various ways. So there's not one way to make wholeness and connection. So she says, I've accessed prajnaparamita through seeing the true totality through various ways, each one particular. Yeah. So the way you feel connected is not going to be the way someone else does. You ever try connecting to someone? Maybe I'm just thinking of when I had like young teenagers connecting to them by saying, let's sit down across from each other face to face and talk about our feelings. Not a winner. It wasn't a winner. I thought that's a great way to connect. It's very meaningful to me. You know, I found it's more effective to just be nearby, alert to how they are, and ready to receive what way they want to connect with me. So Prajnaparamita has this flavor of non-controlling, non-objectifying, which sometimes people will kind of freak out when I say this, but in a certain sense, there's a level of violence to any act of controlling or objectifying, because you've put a split and said, now you're there for me to manipulate. So violence is a strong word, but the idea of nonviolence that pervades Buddhist culture and Buddhist ethics is deeply related to this non-objectification, non-controlling attitude. And I just want to, Martin Luther King once said, this is the unusual thing about nonviolence. Nobody is defeated. Everyone shares in the victory. It's not about winning. The Dhammapada, one of the earliest layers of Buddhist text, says, victory begets enmity. The defeated dwell in pain. Happily, the peaceful live, discarding both victory and defeat. Can you go into difficult situations and relationships not trying to win? I think maybe you can. I think so. I spent a lot of time a couple of years ago showing up for a mass movement to try and stop the building of a pipeline in northern Minnesota that was being built largely through Anishinaabe treaty protected lands through the headwaters of the Mississippi River. It was designed to cross underneath the Mississippi River three times because it's windy, and then go through many, many wild rice beds, which are very susceptible to impacts of infrastructure projects, and was widely opposed by the Anishinaabe people who lived there. And so they said, we want to get a lot of people up here to try and stop this pipeline from being built. And so I went up there many times and did a lot of different things, sang songs, listened to people, told stories, looked at fires, looked at police officers who were not happy I was there. In certain circumstances, there were many arrests made. I was never arrested because it was a nonviolent civil disobedience action. Anyway, they built that pipeline. The pipeline is pumping tar sands oil, which is one of the dirtiest kinds of oil you can get up out of the ground, from Canada through those headwaters, going underneath the Mississippi right now, and being shipped out through Duluth to I don't know where. So I'm happy. Some of my friends who are in the pipeline resistance movement are kind of mad at me because I'm happy. But I'm happy because I never thought I was in control of the outcome. I was enormously grateful that I was able to be in relationship with people who are committed to protecting the earth, building community, and doing it in a way that wasn't about dominating someone else. That's amazing. That's amazing. And that was not easy for me to come by, because I can remember like campaigning when I was like into politics. I campaign and a year of candidate loses, I'd be like, ah, sucks. I give up. I decided I didn't want to live that way. So I practice. I practice. I do still live that way, by the way. My mind does all the things that minds do. So, all this to say, like, if you're awake, you're awake. Bodhi, Buddha, means awake. This tradition says, Soto Zen, the Mahayana tradition says, don't wait to wake up later. You're awake. I mean, are you asleep? How many of you are asleep right now? Well, you couldn't tell me because you'd be asleep. You're awake, which means there's awareness of sounds, sights, body, mental stuff going on, emotions. Can we see this and care about it and make an offering? I think so. And I have to show up and listen to people give Dharma talks and read giant books because I need a lot of reminders, because it's very easy for me to be just like, I just want what I want and everyone get out of my way, like that, or whatever habit I have. Oh, I'm a terrible person. Let me focus on that for a while. That's really fun. It's painful. I don't want to do that. I look for help. I be in supportive communities. I do supportive practice. I look to the teachings of this tradition. So you can do this if you want. You don't have to. I'm just talking a lot this morning. Some of you may be like, that was so weird. I'm going to go home and do something else. I bow to you. I trust your way. I do. People have a lot of innate wisdom. So I would like to take some time with the text of Sudana's encounter with Matriyani here. And so I'm going to do the same where I'm going to read to you. I'm going to read to you about how he comes to the town where she is. He meets her. She gives him a teaching about where you can find Buddha. And then she describes her realization. And I like to find different ways to relate to the text. And what I want to do today is I want to do this as like a listening meditation practice. So I'll read to you. And then at the end, I'm going to guide you through a very brief meditation on the text. So whatever way of arraying your body that would be conducive to some meditative awareness is good. And there are many ways to meditate. This way is intended to be focused on listening and kind of an internal focus. So you might like to close your eyes, but you don't need to. Or if you don't like to close your eyes, you might want to just turn your gaze down so that the focus comes to sound and to your own imagination, because I'm going to let the sutra paint a picture and you can let your mind help you to see it and smell it and feel it, or it is quite sensual. Sudana gradually made his way to the city Simhavijurumbita, looking for the girl Matriyani. He was told, the girl Matriyani, daughter of the Raja Simbaketu with a retinue of 500 girls, is up on the roof of a palace of radiant jewels, sitting on a seat set on sandalwood legs and draped with nets of strings of jewels and arrayed with celestial cloth. She is expounding spiritual teaching. Hearing this, Sudana entered the city, went to the house of the Raja, and stood at the outer foyer, desirous of seeing the girl Matriyani. There he saw hundreds of thousands of people going in. He asked them where they were going and why they had come. And they told him they were going to Matriyani to hear the teaching. He thought to himself, no one is prevented from going in. So he went in. Having gone in, he saw the palace of radiant jewels set on a crystal base with pillars of lapis lazuli and walls of diamond, ornamented with 100,000 projections of gold, furnished with countless jewel mirrors, arrayed with world-illumining jewels, spread with countless jewel nets, graced with inconceivable arrays of beautiful sounds from 100,000 golden bells shaken by the breeze. He also saw the girl Matriyani, with dark eyes, black hair, and golden skin. Sudana paid his respects to her and said, noble one, I have set my mind in supreme perfect enlightenment but I do not know how a bodhisattva is to learn and carry out the practice of a bodhisattva. She said, look at the adornments of my palace. Looking all around in each wall, each pillar, each mirror, each figure, each formation, each jewel, each golden bell, each jewel tree, each girl's body, each jewel necklace, he saw reflected images of the Buddha in the cosmos, with their first inspiration, their sphere of practice and vows, their manifestations of emerging in the world, their mystical transformations on attainment of enlightenment, their turnings of the wheel of teaching, and their ultimate extinction. This he saw in each and every object. Just as the sun, moon, and stars in the sky are seen reflected in a clear, limpid pool of water, so did all the Buddhas of the cosmos appear reflected in each object of the luminous jewel palace. This as a result of the girl Maitreyani's past roots of goodness. Having viewed this, holding in mind the features of this amazing array of visions of Buddhas, Sudana joined his hands in a gesture of respect and turned his attention to Maitreyani's words. She said, I have attained the means of access to perfect wisdom, Prajna Paramita, from the arrangement of totality. I sought this from Buddhas as numerous as grains of sand in 36 Ganges rivers, and those Buddhas introduced me to the means of access to perfect wisdom by way of the arrangement of the totality through various ways of entry into it, each different. Sudana said, what is the sphere of this means of access to perfect wisdom by way of the arrangement of the totality? She said, focusing my attention on this means of access to perfect wisdom by way of the arrangement of totality, by meditating on it, following it, pondering it, contemplating it, making it familiar, keeping it in mind, putting it in order, and putting it into effect, and thoroughly examining it, I developed a mental control called facing in all directions. Just encourage you to let your awareness rest in what is for a moment. Perhaps noticing that you're aware of things in front of you. And without losing awareness of things in front of you, noticing that you are aware of things that are to your sides. And without ignoring that you're aware of things in front of you and to your sides, perhaps notice that you're aware of things behind you. And without ignoring things in front of you or beside you or behind you, perhaps noticing you're aware of things that are above you. And still aware of things in front of us, beside us, behind us, and above us. Notice that we're aware of things below us. still aware of things in front of us, beside us, behind us, above us, and below us. Aware of this very body, sensations of this body right now. Any feelings or thoughts? Simply realizing that awareness is already facing in all directions. I invite you to open the eyes if they're closed and feel free to adjust the body and let your awareness be naturally complete. All right. Well, we have a few minutes where it went kind of long, where people could say things. So there's a lot of people here. So if you'd like to say something, it's nice to say either a very short reflection or a question and say it in a way that's clear and everyone can hear. Go ahead.
I've been reading a book, Being Mortal, by Atul, I can't pronounce his last name. And he was, what I was reading last night, he was talking about end of life, and he talked about assisted suicide, and he said that's actually an out. And he compared, it's like the desire for medicine to like do whatever it takes to keep somebody alive, and that assisted suicide is saying, oh, let's just end it. And then he said that life, you know, has physics, biology, or whatever, and we can't control that. And we have to know that we can't control, which is exactly what you're saying. And then he was saying, but we're not helpless. And then we work with it. And I think that, for me, is always the tricky bit, is to like, okay, we're not in control, but then how are we not helpless?
Yeah. Well, what you do matters. So this is the basic, you know, if you look at the Four Noble Truths, it's very clear. It's like they're suffering and you can do something about it. But what you're doing is not controlling it. If it was, I'd be in nirvana. I'd be like, great, I'm ready. Right. So you can walk the path. And it matters that we walk the path. It matters that we think about the ethics of end of life, which are complex. And there are many different views. So the view of that person is valuable, and other people have different views, and people ultimately make powerful, difficult choices at the end of life. And it's good to hold them all in compassion, facing in all directions, making space for all views and making our choices. Go ahead.
On the subject of nonviolence, how it is easy to apply that philosophy when we're in non-life threatening situation. But if there's a man chasing us, and person with a knife trying to kill us, we cannot do that. We have to harm the other party. Is that the right view?
Yeah, it's a great point. What does nonviolence mean, and are there limits to it? Personally, I'm not an absolute pacifist. I'm like, probably the United States invading Europe. Nonviolence has to do with quality of how we're meeting the moment. So Buddhist ethics are rooted in basically intentionality is what creates the world. So for example, I got mugged at gunpoint about 2 months ago. and I had someone, they actually cut my mouth open so it was bleeding with the firearm. And in that experience, what I was focused on was everyone being safe. That was my experience of it. I was with someone else, and I just hoped no one would be harmed in this situation because guns are really dangerous. Yeah, if someone had been stabbing me with a knife, would I have fought back? I think so. Yeah, ultimately, what will we do in dire situations? We can't know. But we can cultivate a culture where we're continually evoking a sense of care, because that will subtly transform what happens. So it's a great point. I appreciate it. Thank you. Go ahead.
With the kind of heart sutra, and how do you stay compassionate when there's things like violence or there's issues and whatnot, that opening. And the idea of life and death or the completeness. The objectifying versus, I guess if it's not objectifying, it's not out there, it's this interdependence or interconnectedness or the completeness. This, maybe the droplet goes into the ocean, there's this nirvana, I guess, enlightenment, whatnot. And yet we're still this kind of like little self that's objectified. We have an ego, which seems healthy to some degree. And then, so I guess the question is the surrendering the small self into the big self to have this, reserve of compassion or love, and letting go of self. Well, is there still self as far as, like, there's a beautiful teacher, Michael Newhor, Paul in the corner, a gem of Jokoji. I would like it as he passes away or I pass away that our souls travel together and I get to work with him. But the more that I see the karma, the way we're talking about it, it feels like it's not really me who's continuing. It's the big ocean now. So is that continuity or that interconnectedness the reason why that's all love is now? It's that bear or that lion or that person is still me. And so, well, I don't want to get too much. I'm confused about the continuation of self because there's a nice Western part of that that says, ooh, I like the idea of karma because that means I get to keep going. But I get the more I hear about it, it's not really me.
Yeah. Well, it's equivocal. So Buddhist teachings are actually kind of murky in resolving the issue of if there's no self, how is there rebirth? And my actual opinion is never effectively resolved to philosophically. But what it seems like is, it seems like I'm a me and I'm separate from you. I'm assuming everyone else is having that experience. If you're not, congratulations, enjoy your awakening. And so that matters. All the things that seem like objects matter to us. So this isn't about saying they don't matter or somehow magically making them disappear. It's about, this talk is about evoking a different quality of heart or way of relating that can soften and change things. So it's not really about arriving at a philosophical resolution as it is about evoking kinds of feelings and ways of looking at things that are transformative. And in terms of what's reborn, I don't know. I have no memories of any previous lives. If I had a lot of them, I hope they were okay. I hope I didn't do too much harm. But finally, it's kind of outside of the scope of my knowing. But what I do know is all teachings related to rebirth, all teachings related to karma, and the basic teachings of Buddhism say that what you do matters. The quality of intention you bring to your actions has impact that will come to a sentient being. So why not practice for some compassion, for some kindness, for some joyfulness, for some giving. So I think I should wrap up because we got to eat some lunch. Yeah.
Have a little bit more time.
Oh, okay. Well, I got one more person raising their hand.
Thank you for this. This was very mind blowing, to be honest, especially the picture in my mind of being able to see and perceive in all directions was very powerful. I've never had that. Going along what you were kind of just talking about, how the philosophy there is never really resolved, that kind of notion. Can you talk about transiency as being, is that a tenet of Buddhism, is that what that is, the transient nature of self?
Yeah, well, you know, basic idea is everything changes, so we suffer. The trouble I could get into is say that Mahayana Buddhism says nothing actually really comes into being in the first place, so it's not transient. So actually the fact that there's a moment right now, everyone probably thinks, it seems like there's a moment right now. Just because our consciousness happens to think the universe is made of moments doesn't mean they're moments. It's a habit of consciousness to take up whatever the universe is and be like, oh, there's moments and there's a past and a future. Those are just ideas. So ultimately, we can be free of all those. However, because things seem transient, it matters to us. So, you know, when I get sick, I'm like, bummer. I don't like, you know, like I have pain in my back. I like the me that didn't have pain in my back better. So yeah, we suffer because of transience, but our practice can enable us to see things through another lens over time so that we're less caught by it and it's less afflictive. And then, you know, it's like I lost my father. My dad died about 25 years ago and it was so painful. You know, he wasn't that old. It's kind of surprising when it happened. And I had so many unresolved matters with him. So it was wrenchingly difficult. But it was also exquisitely beautiful. And there were moments in that process of profound connection because we actually were able to just be with each other in ways we never had been before, just sitting together, like we sit in a zendo together, without figuring anything out or having any expectation that he was going to survive or that he'd get better. It was just being together in love. And he's definitely dead, you know, like it's hard to deny that, but he's not dead at all. There's no way any of this is happening right now without him. These words are not my words. They're not exactly his words either, but they're definitely not his words. Like none of us is here without people bringing us up. And it's all that stuff they gave us is alive. Sometimes for good and bad, but it's alive. Okay, well, it's been a really wonderful opportunity to share with you all in this way. And I think we get to share some food now, which is really one of the great teaching methods of the universe. So thank you all. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.